oftentimes, and it really is not all that related to the specific teachings, but oftentimes, retreat, when we're on retreat, we turn away from the busyness of our lives. Just the fact that we're quieting down a little bit can be overwhelming sometimes for people, for all of us. It's almost like for the first time in months or maybe years or maybe our whole life, we're allowing ourselves to feel what's going on inside of us, and that can be overwhelming. And that's just to be recognized as part of the process. It's where our minds are in this present moment. It's not something to be run away from or try to avoid. Although we're often taught, especially in the West, that we're only supposed to feel one thing. Whatever we decide is happiness or pleasant, that's what we're after. And anything else is to be avoided. And so we're avoiding most of our lives that way. That's one of the reasons why this process creates so much agitation. We're not living with what's occurring in our own lives. We want it to be different. So if stuff's coming up, let it come up. You know, even if it's painful, it's okay. It's impermanent. I almost said it's permanent. It's not going to last for too long. It's what we're going to talk about today, too. How this whole process is rooted and revolves around impermanence. So it's okay to feel. You know, I remember a talk I gave, and it wasn't much of a talk. It was my first, I was just getting into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a recovered alcoholic. And after a little while, they asked you to get up and talk about, you know, what your experience is. And so this was my first talk. I was sober about 90 days, 26 years old, but I was still shaking. But I remember saying something that I thought, when it came out, I thought, wow, that's really profound. I said, for the first time in 26 years, I can feel something. And I almost stopped talking. Right now, it almost brings me to tears. Because I spent the first 26 years of my life trying to avoid feeling what it was like to live. And that kind of led to what I'm going to talk about today. So I talked last night? About the life of the Buddha and what motivated him to start seeking understanding and a very specific type of understanding. He wasn't trying to understand the great mysteries of life and where he came from and where he might go. He wanted to understand one specific thing. Where does suffering arise from and what's my part in it? And then, most importantly, is there a way to bring that to cessation for all of humanity? So what he awakened to, was dependent origination. So the origination of dukkha depends on ignorance. That's dependent origination. That's the first, that's the beginning. That's the foundation of dependent origination. Do you see it? Mm-hmm. Ignorance, it's ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are dukkha occurs. Craving and clinging establish and perpetuate dukkha. The process can end. So that points to, the Third Noble Truth usually says this, cessation of dukkha can end, but it's pointing to a process that brings us to dukkha. Ignorance of the Four Noble Truths through those 12 observable causative links ends up in suffering, ends up in that first noble truth. The process can end, and the Eightfold Path is the path that brings the process to cessation. It ends the process of ignorant selfing leading to dukkha. Are you following me on the board? So, from ignorance as a, pardon me?
Kind of.
Okay, well, it'll be a little bit more clear when I go through it 2 or 3 or 10 times.
Okay.
But
I know you did this. So you're saying ignorance of the Four Noble Truths.
Yes.
Well, let me get to that. You can get to liberation.
I will. So ignorance of the Four Noble Truths sets that whole process in motion. So what you see, ignorance fabrications ending with birth and dukkha, that's dependent origination. And some of the difficulty with understanding this comes from the way it's interpreted today. And it's hardly ever referenced this way, but you'll see how this is exactly how the Buddha taught it. Dependent origination is usually applied in this way, interdependent origination or interdependent co-arising, which starts implying something completely different than this, that everything is interdependent. And that leads to this idea of a great cosmic unity, that we're all one being, or that we're all connected in some way. And we are in some way, but not in the way that that implies, and not in only in a way that's significant to this. The other way that that's often, dependent origination is often said, well, we're all interconnected. We've all heard that phrase. a famous teacher, I'm not putting him down, calls it interbeing. We're all interbeing. We're all intertwined with each other. And when you start thinking about just those terms, interdependent has nothing to do with dependence, does it? It's a completely different word with a different meaning. Interconnected doesn't have anything to do with dependent. And it implies clinging, doesn't it? It implies a connection where there really isn't. What the Buddha taught is to recognize the discreteness of all phenomena. And it's because of that that allows for cessation. If we were all just one big mass of suffering, all connected, there'd be no way to undo this 12-link chain of dependencies. Is that clear? Because it's so important. This is where most of the confusion arises from, is a misunderstanding of dependent origination, which is what the Buddha awakened to. So
the path is really very much an individual path.
Yes, it's an individual path. And that recognition of our own individual responsibility is the only way that we can undo this. We created this, and this is what this hopefully points out. And when I read the Buddha's words on it, it'll be a little bit more clear than my scratching. But from ignorance, remember, the Buddha is not saying that because we're human beings, you're all ignorant, you know, you're just lost. He's saying that you're ignorant of one specific thing. You're ignorant of the Four Noble Truths. And so that's why he taught the Four Noble Truths, to bring understanding to that. That dukkha occurs, craving originates or establishes dukkha, and clinging perpetuates it. And then he said to me the most important thing, and it points to anicca, to impermanence. The process can end. We're not stuck in it. And there's something we can do to turn that process around. We can develop the Eightfold Path. That's the Four Noble Truths, and that's how they relate to dependent origination. And it's the only way they relate. There's no use in taking dependent origination and trying to apply it in some other way other than this if you want to develop the understanding of a Buddha. You can use it for other things to describe things, but it's only useful in this way. So let me read you what the Buddha's words on dependent origination, because many people... I hear this a lot of times from online students, but even in class, that they've been involved in Buddhism in some way for many, many years, and they've heard dependent co-arising, and they hear it that it means that we're all interdependent, etc., the things that I talk about a lot. And they never hear the Buddha's words on dependent origination. So this is from the Paticca-samuppada Vibhanga Sutta. Vibhanga means important. I mean, pay attention to this one. And it's applied to a lot of different suttas, but this is an important one. This is what the Buddha awakened to. From ignorance, as a requisite condition, comes fabrications. Ignorance to fabrications. Fabrications are what? Fabrications are simply, it's conditioned thinking broken down into its components. So we all have mental fabrications. The way we see things is the way we see things. So I always use politics just because it's such a good example, but not to get political. Often people are brought up in a Republican house, they become Republicans. And without putting a lot of thought to it, and I'm not putting down Republicans, the same is true for Democrats. You create a mental fabrication and you start seeing things in relation to that fabrication. So even things that might turn you away from it, you disregard. From ignorance of the Four Noble Truths comes very specific fabrications. They're fabrications that support ignorance. Many people will ask me this question. Well, doesn't that require... The next one you'll see is fabrications lead to consciousness. Well, don't you need to have consciousness to have ignorance in the first place? And don't you need to have... Yes, you do. But remember, the Buddha is talking about a very specific process. Beginning in ignorance, a mind that's rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths starts forming fabrications based on that ignorance. And from that ignorance, then starts a thought process, a thinking process called consciousness. Remember, that's consciousness with a small c. It's not a grand cosmic consciousness. It's just a way of thinking that's rooted in ignorance. Right? So let me continue with the Buddhist words on this. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. Remember, now this is just ignorant thinking. It's not a grand consciousness that we should be enamored with. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. So name and form is often referred to in the Pali as nama-rupa. So a lot of you have heard that term, nama-rupa. And that's what it means, name and form. Name means identification, self-identification now. From that process, rooted in ignorance, I'm now starting to develop a self-referential ego self. I'm putting a name to it. I'm identifying it. And then form just means that. That form is locked into this physical body. Right? Is everybody following me with that? So now we're starting to create a self-referential ego self based on this physical existence. Yes, of course.
So, also, can maybe this is not appropriate for this space, but from ignorance, fabrications, consciousness, nama-rupa being also, so we're giving, in this instance, this being a name and a form. But also now that that gong is a form, everything is, which is not really solid. All of it, we're solidifying.
Yeah, I don't mean to interrupt
you. It's a distraction.
Yes. Many people insist that dependent origination describes the creation of the universe. And they've taken it so far, and I don't understand how you can really get there from this, and they've taken it saying that this process occurs over three lifetimes. They put a number on it to break it down. There's nothing here that says that. It's not trying to establish the creation.
Yeah, I'm not talking about establishing creation. And I find the way that you're describing this is just sticking to this. Don't worry about the other theories, because the other theories are just a distraction.
Yes.
And then one wants to argue with that.
Like, that's right.
Let's drop that.
So
it's
again,
a thicket of views.
That yeah.
Let's
when,
stick on here.
What I when the Buddha set out to seek an understanding of suffering, he was not concerned with answering the great questions that have bothered mankind. Where do we come from? Where are we going? Is, you know, Vajragoda, he would always ask, are we living in an infinite space or is it finite? Does life go on forever or is there an ending point? Should we be annihilationists? The Buddha was not concerned with those things, so he didn't address those. He found those questions themselves distracting from getting to the heart of the matter. And every time they were brought up, like more is making that point, he would say, disregard the question. It's not important in gaining understanding of his system, if you want to put that word on it.
Mm-hmm. So
it's not important of getting to cessation.
So
those are all just distractions.
Name and form is specifically this name and form.
It's what this ignorant consciousness is residing in and using to refer to itself. Another word for name and form is five clinging aggregates.
Mm-hmm.
So you brought up something else. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that this is established as name and form? Because it's part of the physical world. Yes and no, but the Buddha's not concerned about that, except as we would make an identity with that. So some people, they really like blue, so they're not going to like this brown ball, will they? That's an identity. We've created an identity out of that. We've changed that from being something that is just for that purpose to something that now houses a part of me. I don't like brown gongs. There's an attachment. And so that leads to the whole, you know, I'm a really good drummer. Piano players are really stupid people. We start creating identities over things that have no meaning at all, but it creates tension now, because what's that stupid piano doing in this room for a drummer? And it just goes on and on and on. It leads us to distraction. It leads us to this idea that there's such a thing as a cosmic oneness that houses me. That's all just a distraction. It's not important. Even if you can establish it as true in some way, as far as this course is concerned, the Buddhist curriculum, it's a distraction.
It leads directly to.
So yeah, let me get back to the Buddha's words on this, and then we'll go through it. And what I really hope to bring about this morning is that nexus point at impermanence. So this morning we're going to talk about how this gets established. This afternoon we're going to use dependent origination to de-establish this whole process and see how that works. So I'll just go back a few steps. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. I'm starting to identify myself as this. Rooted in ignorance. Remember, everything goes back to that initial ignorance. From name and form, now I'm identifying myself, as a requisite condition comes the sixth sense base. What does that mean? Because the sixth sense base is always here if we have a physical form. The sixth sense base is our five physical senses and that sixth sense of mind or consciousness. But remember, consciousness with a small c, rooted in ignorance. From the sixth sense base, as a requisite condition, comes contact. So follow that. From ignorance of the Four Noble Truths comes fabrications that are rooted in ignorance. From that fabrication rooted in ignorance comes an ignorant way of looking at the world, an ignorant way of thinking. Anything that is rooted in ignorance can only lead to more ignorance, unless something else intervenes. And we're going to get to the intervening part. From that consciousness with a small c, comes an identification of this thing as me, and this is all that I am. We become attached to this physical being as this is me. But this is the beginning of the process, and it deepens. From that identification, through the sixth sense base, this thing called name and form, rooted in ignorance, now has contact with the outside world through our senses. Something occurs. And we identify and determine what that occurrence is in relation to this self based on ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. And so that contact now leads to a feeling. And it's a feeling. A feeling doesn't mean just a physical feeling, and it doesn't mean just an emotional feeling. It means any response to that process that is being described. And this process is not entirely in linear time. In other words, this process happens so quickly that we can't notice it. Scientists are getting to that point now with those big, what do they call them, the big accelerators. They're trying to find the God particle, that thing that is underlying everything else. That's what this refers to. But we can't see it. It happens too quickly. But we can see the results of the process, and that's how we can intervene in that process. So let me continue with the words of the Buddha, too. And I know I'm bouncing back and forth, but I want to tie it together to that last thing on the bottom there. From contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. So now I've had, through contact with the outside world, remember I have, my thinking is rooted in ignorance at this point. Something occurs. Somebody gives me my first, I always use this chocolate cake. Somebody gives me my first piece of chocolate cake. It might have happened when I was 2 years old. It might have happened when I was 10. Somebody gives me that first piece of chocolate cake and I love it. I got a feeling about it. And I'm craving more. And I've just created an identity of someone who loves chocolate cake. And now, unless something intervenes in that, I'm going to spend the rest of my life craving chocolate cake. And when it's around, I'm going to be clinging to it. I'm going to notice it. I'm going to notice there's a piece of chocolate cake on that counter. I hope nobody else gets it before I get it. That's craving and clinging. And it's a simple and direct and practical explanation of how this happens in every occurrence in life. It's not just chocolate cake. We do it with every single thing that we create an identity. A pretty smile. Our dog. But the other thing is true, too. We have an interaction with someone. It doesn't end in a smile. It ends in a scowl or an argument. There's another identity in there. I don't like that, and I don't like that person because of how they made me feel. We're creating discursive thoughts based on feeling. We're now saying that I'm putting conditions on my life, conditioned thinking. I only want certain occurrences. And one of the things that I do not want is I don't ever want to see that person again. So, or the thing of what Og Mandino always used, a cat jumps up on a hot stove, he'll never jump up on that stove again. He'll never be able to find a good meal for himself. We do the same thing. We get burned once, there's aversion. That's conditioned thinking. I'm getting away from doing this very clearly, but I'm just making the point, Ram.
So the feelings just break down into like, dislike, neutral.
Yes, yes. Okay. You can put any feeling in one of those three classes.
Okay.
Yeah, and most of our feelings are neutral, and so we're missing out on most of life. We only want to be paying attention to the things that give us pleasure or what we need to avoid, and in the rest of that process is life unfolding. We ignore. And when we can develop the refined mindfulness through the Eightfold Path, we're able to be present with those things that we've been ignoring. What is the root of the word ignoring? It's ignorance. And it leads to continued ignorance. The process of missing out on most of life, which we do by this discursive process of chasing likes and avoiding dislikes, is rooted in ignoring those things. It's rooting in the ignorance. And what's in between that, I know I'm getting a little bit mystical here maybe, what's in between looking for pleasure and avoiding pain is understanding the Four Noble Truths, recognizing how dukkha occurs. Is that clear? It'll be more clear as we go along.
So instead of ignoring everything that's going on, except when you're enjoying life or really not enjoying life, turn your attention to the Four Noble Truths. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, boy. Yes, get up here. Teach the class. You said it a lot simpler than I am. So. And in that pleasure avoidance is where the five clinging aggregates reside.
Mm-hmm. So do you see how that's those how guys.
That's where that's how ignorance is maintained through this self identity. You hear me say it often. Anatta, that which the Buddha said is not a self, must establish itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs. Or what happens? The whole system breaks down. I was going to talk about this a little bit later, and I will. If you can deeply penetrate any one of those links and undo any one of those links, for instance, craving and maintaining leads to becoming. If you can deeply understand that and stop that process, the whole causative chain falls apart. That's another way of describing the process of awakening. One of the ways, and don't put too much thought to that because that can become very, very complicated in our clinging minds because we resist it so much. This is just to explain the process of how from ignorance suffering arises. And then once you understand the process, I advise everyone to forget it and have the experience of developing it. But it's important to understand how this process occurs. This is what the Buddha awakened to dependent origination. And he spent the rest of his life teaching how to deal with it. So don't make too much. In fact, I said last night, the Buddha didn't even teach this until at least 6 or 8 months and probably a couple of years into his teaching, so people had a context to understand it. But I think we can understand it. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. Clinging and maintaining is the same thing. Clinging is maintaining. Holding on to things maintains that our attention towards things that we crave. And things that we crave can be negative or positive, to put those words. Wanting to avoid things that bring us displeasure is a form of craving, isn't it? It's desiring to avoid those things. Even when the Buddha described suffering and he described being separated from that which is love, is pointing out craving and clinging, right? It all ties back into those teachings, same teaching. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. What does that mean? Comes becoming. So now we've decided the type of life we want through craving and clinging, rooted in ignorance. And all of our efforts now are going towards creating a life that satisfies those needs. That's becoming. This isn't a mystical becoming. It's not trying to describe, and again, people try to use dependent origination to describe physical birth. The Buddha's not teaching that. What he's saying is that because of ignorance through this process, we're giving birth ongoing to continued ignorance, which can only lead to suffering. Is that clear? That's an important point. Each moment holds the potential to continue down the road of ignorance, creating more suffering, or to develop the refined mindfulness rooted in concentration and develop as a fully mature human being, as awakened. And I'm working my way down to those three words at the bottom. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. So birth is way down this line of dependencies, isn't it? It's not the beginning of the process. And again, we're not getting into mystical or even physical birth. We're talking about giving birth to a process that ends up in suffering. Nothing mystical or magical, entirely practical. Clinging and maintaining leads to becoming. Becoming through this process leads to birth. And so you can say it's physical birth too, and we can get into karma and rebirth, but I tend to avoid that because it doesn't lead to clarity of this situation. But it's the process of giving birth to each successive ignorant moment. Rooted in ignorance, we can only give birth to ignorance, resulting in suffering occurring. But if we can find a way to interrupt that process, then we can determine where that process ends. And so what interrupts ignorance but knowledge, understanding, wisdom? Right view. Right view is the beginning of unraveling this. That's why the Eightfold Path starts there. If that's not clear what I just said, it will be. I hope, and if it's not, please question me on it. One of the things the Buddha said, He said, and this was in a response to a monk that had learned the Dhamma, went off by himself, decided it must be something else, and came back, and the Buddha heard about this and called him in and says, you got to bring him back in here because he's messing everybody up. And the Buddha said, you know, tell me what you think. And he went on, Buddha says, you're a foolish man. And your foolishness is going to lead to your long-term suffering and others' suffering. He said, that's not the Dhamma that I teach. He was trying to maintain his views that were rooted in ignorance rather than wisdom. And so the Buddha taught an eightfold path so that we can develop wisdom instead of being rooted in that ignorance. Begins with right view. It begins with a view that I don't quite understand the Four Noble Truths, but they make sense. I can see where they're valuable. Let me begin to learn how to understand it, to develop that understanding. That's initial right view. Mundane right view has this whole thing covered. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. From birth as a requisite condition comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair. And it's that last line that people have said, well, then it's ignorance that causes physical birth, because the Buddha is talking about sickness, aging, and death. Birth, sickness, aging, and death. But remember, the Buddha is not so much concerned about physical rebirth, because he knows that if we can fully develop this path, there will be no more. The first thing the Buddha said when he awakened and touched the ground with his right hand, he said, I have overcome the world. For me, there will be no more future births. Something that most people don't even want to face. But the point of the Dhamma is to stop creating the conditions for further physical births. But more importantly, the way we do that is to be mindful of each moment and what we're giving birth to in this moment. And that's how we interrupt kama or karma and cease the further becoming. But the most important further becoming is, what am I becoming in this next moment? Pointing to that word I used last night, selfing. What am I selfing? What am I creating for myself? Judy.
So it's really a continued unenlightened birth that brings Sika.
Yes.
Not the last one. But all the ones that come together,
yeah,
with the last one.
Yes.
That you're talking about.
Yep.
And I have a question.
Please.
It keeps coming up in my head. Am I totally, I love everything and I'm into this, but isn't following this and wanting lasting peace, and isn't that in itself a
desire?
That's a skillful desire.
It's such an important question,
desire,
though. Okay. There's a word for it, chanda, which happened to be the Buddha's handler when he left the palace grounds, but it's also a Pali word that means skillful desire. And remember, the Buddha taught a middle way, and he taught a middle way for human beings, and he understood the nature of desire, and he used it in this way. There's nothing wrong with inclining your mind towards awakening and having the skillful desire to awaken. It's not rooted in ignorance anymore. It's rooted in right view. Because it's rooted in right view, it can deliver the cessation. Is that clear how that is? And it's that skillful desire, then, that has us come up against all of our unskillful desires and what they've created. And that's what really creates the difficulty for us, when we start coming up against these hardened desires. We can attach ourselves to that notion, and a lot of people do. Well, we should get rid of all desire, so I can't even have this desire to awaken. It was the strong desire that the Buddha had to awaken that kept him going for 6 years, through all of those things that he went through. It's skillful desire. It's something that's rooted in the Eightfold Path that keeps us going in that direction. Maura, you're going to say something?
Yes. So, and it's my understanding that until we fully awaken, there's going to be lots of, our thinking is going to be confused, and therein lies compassion. But we know where we're going. We know the direction, and we understand the roots of suffering, and we understand what unbinds suffering. So, and keeping that in mind is where we, holding that in mind is what gives compassion and insight to change where you place your focus.
Yeah.
So it doesn't obviously mean you can't have chocolate cake and stuff like that, but just watching this stuff and knowing, as I said kind of this morning in meditation, that we have this great opportunity and to not minimize that and to embrace that fully. and put some effort and energy behind it.
The desire to awaken, to fully mature as a human being, is rooted in right view. It's rooted in wisdom. It's starting to incline the mind in the right way, in the skillful way. And it's such an important question, because that also has led many people to then use that skillful desire to awaken and attach it to a path that won't lead to awakening. Now I've created an identity about the Dharma, and that's all I need to do. And that's an aspect of desire that's rooted, that ultimately takes us back to ignorance, because the path doesn't lead there. So again, the Buddha taught a very clear path that guides our awakening. And I know I say it over and over again because it's the most important thing. It's that eightfold path that keeps us going in the right direction. It keeps channeling our desire to awaken in a useful and skillful way, rather than get caught up in more ignorant views, more extreme views. Remember, the eightfold path is a middle path. So it's such an important, and it's something to be mindful of. What is my real desire here? What's my intention in each moment? Jen first, and then Kevin.
So the way I think about it is that just because I know that I have an ego, it doesn't mean my ego goes away.
No.
And that being the case, I still have to kind of work with that knowledge. So it's kind of like, I know that I'm blindfolded, but I'm still, like, so I'm being a little more careful about how I make my decisions on where I'm going to put my foot. That being the case, desire is something I have to deal with, because I still have an ego.
You're describing the beginning of right view, and now right view points you to the eightfold path, and the eightfold path, that sixth factor of the eightfold path, and with the other ones, right effort keeps that desire going in the right way. It doesn't allow now desire, a natural human desire, to lead to more confusion and some more suffering. Again, that's where that path, the Buddha developed the eightfold path because he understood conditioned thinking and confirmation bias. He knew that we needed a way to direct these thinking. Even a simple concept like the desire to awaken can be used by the ego personality to confuse us further. Mm-hmm. So, but there is a function. The ego personality is something that's rooted in ignorance. And the Buddha is the best example of this. An awakened human being doesn't lose the ability to relate to the world. But then the ego is just a function of an awakened mind, a mind that's rooted in a deep, refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, instead of the overriding determination of our life to feed the ego, which can never be satisfied. It's in its proper place, to say it another way. It's simply a function of the mind, rather than the determining characteristic of the mind. An important distinction there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very clear distinction.
Good.
Thank you.
Kevin?
Yeah, I don't want to say what I was thinking about during that, but skillful desire, you know, going back to the Buddha's words, I teach the nature of dukkha and I teach the cessation of dukkha, the skillful desire to abandon that which causes us dukkha.
That's, yeah. Which,
because the skillful desire to awaken is, as you just said it, like you hit it right on the head, that's feeding an ego instead of abandoning and experiencing life moment to moment, which, look at this, maybe this feels like awakening, which, you know, I'm just thinking abandoning, clinging, and craving, and that which causes
dukkha. Yep. Maura talked about that this morning, too. This feeling in meditation when the self falls away, and it feels wonderful. It feels like emptiness. That's it, I'm awakened.
Right.
And now you've created a whole religion about emptiness that had nothing to do with the Buddha because of that one feeling. And everybody has that experience. And I'm not putting it down. It's such a powerful feeling. It seems like what we're looking for. And it's just the opposite. It's just another distraction. We've now negated the process that I hope I get to soon. We've negated the process of becoming when we've become fixated on anything that describes awakening.
It's like the result is awakening from the skillful desire of abandoning that which causes
awakening. Yeah, that's beautiful.
It's like by the way, that happens.
It's part of it. Don't get stuck on that. It's one of the things that Vajragoda kept asking, because I can imagine, in the Pali Canon, you can I can read between the lines. Bacha Goda kept coming in and out of the Buddha's life. He'd walk away for a year or so, come back. So I imagine in that time, Bacha Goda's going, and he's sitting, and he's having these great mystical experiences about meditation and feeling all kinds of emptiness and cosmic connection, and he comes back to the Buddha and says, I think I got it. No, that ain't it. And the Buddha kept pointing him back to the Eightfold Path, and he resisted it through his whole life. Most of the stories of the people that keep recurring to the Buddha eventually get it and awaken. I've yet to come across anywhere in the Pali Canon where Vajragoda got it. So he was really stuck on his views. Not everybody gets it. Mark?
You said something that resonated with me. I want to make sure I understood it correctly too. So what I interpreted from what you said was that the ego, when you reach awakening, doesn't go away. It's just, I think of it, I guess I visualize it as the thought constructs that kind of run through your mind. You're just abstract,
right? That's right.
So it's still there. It's just you have that control over it at that point. Is that
at that point the mental fabrications fall aside?
So it becomes less and less. So it's not even that you have to control it. It's just
if you think of anatta, the Buddha's description of anatta is simply what you think of yourself is not a self. Awakening is the dropping away, the letting go of all those views rooted in ignorance. And so what's left? When the Buddha talks about the five clinging aggregates in an awakened sense, he simply leaves that word clinging out. There's still five aggregates, but there's no clinging self. There's no self-referential, that's the best words that I can use to describe it. There's no self-referential ego personality left.
There's nothing continually trying to establish
itself.
As these five aggregates are mine.
Right.
Yes.
This is me.
And so what happens then? And it happens, that final leap from delusion to awakening happens in an instant, but it for most of us, it builds gradually. And it builds gradually by recognizing and letting go of all ignorant views. Most of us can't do it at once. Kandana could. Most of us, it takes a couple weeks, you know, maybe. But and it's a process of recognizing these ignorant views, just like the Buddha did in his final meditation before he awakened. He recognized every ignorant view, put them aside. And at the end of that, he awakened. And then he taught us how to do it. And he understood that it's not enough to say what we're doing, because we have this thing called conditioned mind. So he gave us an eightfold path to walk our way through our own conditioned thinking. Again, that's the key to the Buddha's awakening, is this path. And remember, his awakening to him is simply being released from clinging and developing a calm mind. By putting all of these things can be seen as agitations. We put them all aside. And I'll say it for the second time today. If we can just penetrate one of these links, and it could be anyone for any one of us, the whole chain of dependencies fall apart. And each one of these links will be recognizable depending on the situation we're in our lives. Another way of saying that is refined mindfulness is situational. We'll apply it depending on what's occurring right now. I was going to think it was Howard, but it was one of my students online. Tony will hear this, it's on tape. Talks about it's like a game of whack-a-mole. Ron talked about that too. We put aside one ignorant view, here comes another one. We recognize that one, let it go, and there's another one over there. Constantly distracted by it. But eventually, our minds calm down. We develop that deep concentration through shamatha vipassana meditation within the broader framework. And those things start popping up a little bit more slowly. And there's a little bit more space between them. We're able to handle it more and more. And eventually, we whack the last mole down. And the morning star rises. Howard.
So is that the space where you, instead of reacting, you respond?
Yes. Yes.
But it's a process. One time you're doing it, just gets...
Yeah, there's some times, and I think we've probably all experienced, where it feels like we got the whack-a-moles quieted down quite a bit. And the next day we go to sit, and there they are again. It's all situational. It's what's going on. But along the way, another way for saying we're deepening our concentration is we're creating spaciousness. A lot of people describe meditation as creating spaciousness. It's a good word, because what we're doing is we're creating space between one thought following another thought. There's just a little bit of space that there's not a anatta established there. And as we progress, we're starting to unravel this chain of dependencies. We're starting to undo dependent origination.
It's a day-to-day thing where you are no longer, you know, giving this knee-jerk response to things that are happening in your life.
Yes.
You just have that ability to step back just a hair and see it come up and then say, oh, I don't have to do this this way. I can have a skillful response to this.
Yes, and that just a hair is the beginning of right view. It's the beginning of establishing this process that I'm going to talk about in just a second. But we have to do something, most of us, to establish that hair. That's a good word. We have to do something to interrupt conditioned mind need to establish itself in every thought that occurs. And that's what this process is. That's why meditation is only one part of it. It starts rooting concentration in our minds. And then the other seven factors give us the ability to see where our craving is. We talked about this a little bit last night. Most people, that begins with right speech when they start recognizing it, because it's usually so obvious where we're craving and clinging when we're looking at right speech. A very practical application. That's why it's there. The right speech, right action, right livelihood are moral and ethical or virtuous factors which have led Buddhism to be attached to religion, because religions do the same thing. And the Buddha's not saying we shouldn't look at these to be better human beings. But the underlying importance is to recognize craving and clinging, because that's where it comes out. Where else would it come out? We're human beings. Our craving and clinging is most obvious in our interaction with the world, isn't it? And our interaction in the world is characterized by speech, action, and what we're doing to make a living. Maury, you had a question or comment? No? Let me just go a little bit further, and I want to talk about those three on the bottom. And that will be enough for today, I think. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. From birth as a requisite condition comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair. So notice that this... Excuse me, I got something in my... piece of breakfast. Good. Breakfast wasn't that impermanent today. Notice that the 12-link chain does not lead to the establishment of a permanent self, but to a confused mind prone to further confusion, delusion, and suffering. That points back to what we're giving birth from ignorance. And that's just an ongoing process. The flowery term is wandering in samsara. Samsara is just ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. So now the Buddha wants to talk about, in slightly more detail, in a reverse order, each of the 12 links. So now, what is aging and death? Like most of us don't know. Wait till you get to be my age or older, you'll know. Now, what is aging and death? Aging is decrepitude. Brokenness. Graying. Well, I don't have it. Decline. Weakening of the faculties. That's coming. Death is the passing away of five clinging aggregates. The ending of time and the interruption in the life faculties. The ending of time. It's no longer significant. You're not here anymore. It's only significant while you're here and you can do something about it.
Is that the big death or like the death?
It can be either one.
Okay, because you can just do it in an instant.
Yep. Now, what is birth? Birth is the descent. Now, think about birth in this terms. Doing something that continues your ignorance and continues more suffering. And look at it, and now the Buddha is describing that process rather than a human birth. Now, what is birth? Birth is the descent. Descent is usually not something good. Birth is the descent, the coming forth, the coming to be, not of a human body, but of ignorance, but of dukkha, rooted in ignorance. Birth is the descent, the coming forth of the First Noble Truth. Dukkha occurs.
Is that what is written there?
Well, I'm adding that character. I'll just read what the Buddha's words are. Now, what is birth? Birth is the descent, the coming forth, the coming to be. Birth is the appearance of the six sense bases and the five clinging aggregates. The six sense bases don't have any significance unless we've followed their following name and form, a self-referential ego personality stuck in a body. That's that process of descent. When the Buddha described the five clinging aggregates, he usually used that term at the end of describing suffering. In other words, sickness, aging, death, lamentation, sorrow, blah, blah, blah. In short, he would say, in short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. So it's not, we're not, the five clinging aggregates when we're stuck in this delusion, that's not something separate to dukkha. Dukkha doesn't happen to the five clinging aggregates. the experience of this process is dukkha. We're stuck in the process. We can't see anything other than that until we get that little hair that Ram was talking about, that I could use some. And it starts to interrupt this process. It starts to interrupt ignorance. It starts to interrupt conditioned thinking. Something has to interrupt it, doesn't it? That's conditioned means it's going to keep going on unless something starts to decondition it. Now, what is becoming? Becoming is sensual becoming. Form becoming and formless becoming. So formless becoming, it took me a while to really get this until I put it into context. I thought, well, isn't that speaking to emptiness, to that experience? But when you put it in context, the Buddha is describing dukkha. So entering into that space of emptiness, the formless becoming, whether it's in a mental aberration or a physical death, is part of suffering. It's nothing to chase after. Let me say it again. So now what is becoming? So becoming in the process follows clinging and maintaining. We're pretty far along into the establishment of the experience of suffering. Now what is becoming? Becoming is sensual becoming. We're using our sixth sense base. Something makes me feel good. I want more of something. Whatever it is. Chocolate cake always comes to mind. That's becoming. I'm becoming a person who needs chocolate cake. I'm becoming a person who needs a pleasant sunset every night. I'm becoming a person.
That's me.
Maura left last night. Everybody was wondering what happened to Maura. She went to see the sunset.
Clinging aggregate.
That's a perfect example. But the best thing about that is Maura didn't beat herself up for it. She just did it. She knows herself well enough that at that moment, the sunset was more important than this brilliant teaching. Good for you. Now,
she doesn't need to beat up herself. There's somebody else.
Through insinuation. Now, what is becoming? Becoming is sensual becoming, form becoming, and formless becoming. It's simply that whole process that we use. In that one sentence, the Buddha is describing the ongoing process of creating suffering, creating dukkha in our lives. Jen?
I really, before today, really, like, after, when she got to sixth sense base, I fell off. I was like, yeah, I don't get it. Okay, that's fine. I get enough into it. Now I'm with you. I'm with you at coming.
Wow, we're getting
it. So I just want to make sure, I mean, it's almost like, now I'm my ego. Now my ego is driving the ship.
Yeah.
Is that becoming?
That's where you are at that point, yes.
Yeah.
Your self-referential ego self, that which the Buddha said is anatta, is now driving the ship.
Right.
Becoming has been established, and it's established in ignorance. So any further becoming, anything that occurs after that point, is rooted in ignorance and can only lead to dukkha at that point. And that's the important point to remember. So let me just, more. Are you clear or clear enough?
Because because what you had said, and maybe I literally zoned out for a second. You had said something that you finally understood something about the formless in there, and that it was just too many.
I'm sorry.
Disappeared. No, they just disappeared. I didn't really hear what you said the first time. Then I asked for clarification, and I zoned out.
When I was, I don't want to.
I was thinking about that sunset. I swear.
I've talked about my own experience in developing, and you know, through the Tibetan schools, I took my vows and became dissatisfied. Went through the Zen teachings, and there was always this underlying search for emptiness and nothingness. And of course, it can't be achieved, so I never achieved it. And then when I first came across this, I thought the Buddha was referring, when he's saying the formless, I thought he was referring to that.
So where is he saying formless? Can you read that?
Yeah, let me read his words on it. Now what is becoming? All right, put it in perspective.
Okay.
What is becoming?
Mm-hmm.
Following craving and maintaining. Becoming is sensual becoming.
Mm-hmm.
Becoming, form becoming,
mm-hmm.
And formless becoming.
And formless becoming.
And initially, and a lot of people say that is talking about emptiness. It's talking about death.
Right.
It's talking about that ongoing cycle in a way of placing importance on it. Form becoming is the, through the sixth sense base, is the establishment of a self.
And formless becoming is what?
Formless is the in this context, it's the belief that there's something valuable in the formless, in the emptiness. It's just as the Buddha's describing, remember, he's describing the nature of suffering. He's not placing formless as a something to achieve or something to chase after.
Right.
The belief,
there's a self that creates formless. The belief
in the formless is the belief in the formless is rooted in ignorance.
Gotcha.
There's nothing to chase after. And most of us that have been looking at Buddhism, we're lucky if you haven't, because you don't think that there's something here to chase after. You don't think that the formless is something that's desirable. Belief in the formless is rooted in ignorance. Let it go.
So a common, more or less common experience for people that were pursuing other kinds of meditation at that time.
Oh yeah, both Alara Kadama and Udaka Ramaputta taught very similar meditations that ended up in the experience of a formless state in some way. Alara, I think, was the one that taught to develop this mental state of neither perception nor non-perception.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds
like
a little crazy,
Sutra.
But I don't want to get into that today, but it is the Heart Sutra. That's all I'll say about the Heart Sutra. Now you brought it up. Form and formless. Yeah, there it is. So I'm not going to go there. But
because you're on a really good roll.
So you can see this was a very good discussion on how we become enamored with something that is just part of dukkha, the formless state. That sounds, I want to get to the formless state. Then I don't got to deal with the form anymore. It's just as much of a delusion.
You said this morning about sitting and then you have that empty space and you're like, yeah, that's it. Like, that's basically what you're talking about.
It is. And the Buddha was talking about this. It's not just a modern occurrence. Again, this whole idea of emptiness and nothingness, the cosmic unity and the interdependence has a longer history than the Buddha. It's rooted in the Vedas. And much of modern Buddhism now is more Veda-like, especially the more Advaita types of Buddhism, because that's rooted in the Vedas, than what the Buddha taught. Again, I'm not putting it down. It's just important to have the distinction.
Like Thanissara would say, it's not all the way. It's not there. It's still suffering.
Well, you still need to understand this process. So,
well, let's keep on this.
A little bit more, and then I just want to explain this a little from what's on the chart. This is explaining that the belief in a self is reinforced by sensory contact and is proliferated by believing in an individual personality being born or becoming formed. This belief is rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. It is also ignorance of the Four Noble Truths to hold the belief that an ego personality becomes formless at death but survives physical death as the same personality. There's a lot of belief in that. We love that. I mean, that's such a great idea. That even if my life is awful, I'm going to get another chance, you know? And some religions will teach, no matter how bad your life is, if you follow a certain way of living, you're good to go in another life. The Buddha is saying that cycle itself is real, and it is real. But remember what he said when he awakened, and many times after he awakened during his teaching. He touched the earth and said, I have overcome the world. For me, there will be no more future births. We don't want it. We don't want to give birth to a future physical birth, but most importantly, we don't want to give birth to another ignorant moment, because that's what's going to drive that future physical birth. And we have a choice. Why?
I caution, so I was just going to say it, and then maybe, I don't know that it's relevant, because it becomes a thicket of views and all that.
Then let's go back to
it.
Yeah. Thank you, Matt.
You mean the talk of rebirth?
No, I was just saying, like, you know, when somebody's passed on, and, you know, there's still this whole clinging to this idea.
Well, that is, and again, when those questions came up to the Buddha, he would point it out that way. Stay away from it. It's just a thicket of views. You can't make any sense of it because it's nonsense. Everybody has an opinion of it, too,
but
of the experience.
But this formless piece.
That's what the Buddha is pointing to as formless. simply to say, stop thinking about it. It's part of ignorance. That the idea of it itself is rooted in ignorance. And it's at the end of this process. You've already established becoming. And if it's rooted in ignorance, that becoming can only lead to birth of each moment. And that ignorant birth of each moment leads to dukkha, leads to the first noble truth. Dukkha occurs. So the Buddha was so concerned, his only concern was to understand dukkha and possibly, is there a way to bring it to cessation? And he realized upon his awakening that yes, and the path was this eightfold path. So those three words at the bottom, let me just explain it this way. Selfing occurs from rooted in ignorance in the process of dependent origination. Rooted in ignorance through this process of selfing, we've given birth to a self that is prone to dukkha. And included in dukkha is confusion, deluded thinking, and all manner of suffering. Right? You're with me there. From selfing, through that process, comes dukkha. In the process that the Buddha teaches, from that process of ignorant selfing, through the Eightfold Path, brings liberation from the process. So the back and forth arrows, the nexus point in this whole process is impermanence, is anicca. And notice, I could have put one more arrow from anicca to the third noble truth. The process can come to an end because of anicca. It's at that nexus point, and that impermanence is what's occurring right now. Look at it that way. Look at it as a practical experience of your life as your life is unfolding, moment by moment. Each moment is different than the previous moment, even though there's continuity. Even though we've been sitting in this room now for an hour, everything that has occurred is a series of impermanent events. The continuity obscures that. But nevertheless, everything is still impermanent. We know that. I mean, the scientists have proven that. The Buddha described these things called kleshas 2,600 years ago as infinitesimally minute particles of energy that blink into existence and blink out of existence in the blink of an eye, millions of them. He's describing something that scientists are just now coming to agreement on. But he's describing impermanence. That has been occurring while we've been sitting here. Within that impermanence is the opportunity to end ignorance of the Four Noble Truths and begin to establish wisdom through the Eightfold Path. So impermanence, this moment, is the nexus point between selfing leading to dukkha or selfing leading to liberation. And that's the whole point of dependent origination, to understand and pointing to the Four Noble Truths, that from ignorance of this process, which is what the ego personality needs to survive, from ignorance of this process, dukkha occurs. If we start developing the Eightfold Path, which is a deep concentration practice rooted in the refined mindfulness of the rest of the path, then the arrow goes backwards into the self and we can undo that process. And it's happening in each and every moment. So if there's one thing to take from this long-winded explanation, is that, and this is not to I'm going to talk a little bit about the worship of the present moment. What's occurring now, what is becoming in yourself right now, another way of saying that, what you yourself is becoming, and it's an ongoing process, is the thing to be most mindful of. And what do you want to become? And it's okay to say, well, I really like this ego personality. I want more of that dukkha, because that's really interesting. Or you can do what the Buddha realized and wake up and say, I don't want any more of that. I'm going to develop this path, and I'm going to develop a life of lasting peace and happiness. And that's the choice we have in each moment. Now, just to talk a little bit about the present moment, and just to put some clarity on it, the present moment and even modern applications of mindfulness have created an almost a new religion of the present moment, and we're to worship the present moment. And that creates its own kind of agitation and tension because we always want to be in this present moment. There's no such thing. According to the Buddha, according to this teaching, life is simply an ongoing process of becoming. And if we start worshiping what's occurring in the present moment, we're losing noticing the process of becoming an awakened human being. There is no, and again, I'm not putting down a specific person, even though it's the title of his book, there's no power in now. I'm really not. There's no, his teachings are rooted in something different too. There's no power in now because there's no such thing as now. And if we keep trying to attach ourselves to now, what is it? It's more attachment. It's more getting to the place where I've had this feeling of emptiness. That's now. That's what I want. And I want to keep having that now. You can't because there's no now. Everything, the key understanding of all of this is that that middle ground between selfing impermanence and dukkha and selfing impermanence and liberation. Everything is in a process because everything is impermanent, including that wonderful now. There's no such thing.
And that's and where Kundana...
That's what Kundana got when he awakened. All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation, including the condition of the present moment, of the now. That now, if we start worshiping the now, whatever we become, the perfect Buddhist, I got the perfect practice, I have the perfect teaching, attach yourself to that. Even this process, the way that the Eightfold Path is best understood is as a framework. But as a framework, it doesn't define what's occurring in this moment. Everything is a situation in this moment. And the refined mindfulness allows us to see that clearly. It allows us to see our own becoming. Almost every one of us has talked about how the developing this path has begun to change things in their minds a little bit. There's a little bit more spaciousness. Everybody but Maura. The exception, there is Dukkha. We've all described gaining a little bit of spaciousness or seeing things a little bit differently, seeing things with a little bit level, a little bit more of a refined mindfulness. That's recognizing that process that's in the impermanence. Remember that karma, that thing that we think we're all stuck in, is part of this. Karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional acts. I should point that up there. The present moment unfolding of past intentional acts modified by our present moment of mindfulness. And if our present moment of mindfulness is the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, then we're turning our karma towards awakening. Karma is part of impermanence. Karma is part, it's not something that's fixed. It's not something, I was talking to someone last night about Angulimala. Angulimala killed 99 people and he was ready to kill the Buddha until the Buddha gave him the Dhamma, he awakened, and he never harmed another soul. And then the Buddha talks about, and Angulimala lived as a well-respected member of the Sangha and never came back to earth. He finished, the Buddha said his holy life was finished. That belies the what people teach as karma. If you kill a person, you got to have a death where you have to have a life where you're killed. If you killed 99 people, you got to have 99, you got to have the same experience. They're teaching that karma is some kind of cosmic balance. And that's how it was taught during the Buddha's time. And he said, no, karma is the present moment unfolding of past volitional actions, intentional actions, modified by the present state of your mindfulness. If your mindfulness is rooted in ignorance, the only karma you can have is karma that's going to end up in continued dukkha. If your karma is such at this moment, you're developing refined mindfulness of something that's useful, the Eightfold Path, then your karma is ultimately going to end up in liberation. So karma does not predetermine anything. It's just to be recognized as a word that describes what? It describes who you are in this present moment. If you want to look in the mirror, you'll see the same thing that can be described two different ways. Look in the mirror, you'll see anatta, and you'll see your karma. Neither one of those is fixed. It's up to you what you want to self. So that's the end of this morning's talk. And I'm going to... This afternoon's talk is going to be more on dependent origination. I hope I don't overload you, but how this process gets undone, how we undo this. So any questions about this? And I want to ask, and I keep asking, let me ask the question. I've asked a few of you last night, is this too much information? Okay. And I don't think it is either. I wouldn't be doing it, but I just want to make sure because I think in the context it isn't too much information. We can see how it relates. We don't have to struggle with where do I put this. And I think just the talk on dependent origination without the context we all have is very confusing. It was to me until I put it in context. So we're going to go into this a little bit more this afternoon. Tonight, it's a nice setting. Well, I'll talk on the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. The Buddha... And we can dance later. You can even dance during if you want, but you don't want me to dance. You don't want to see that. That's an experience of dukkha, let me tell you. That's suffering.
I don't want any more of that.
That's something you don't want to become, let me tell you. Lorna, you had a question?
Actually, it's a request. When you read from your tablet, whatever it is, can you just read a little slower?
I can't. that's my condition.
I will.
What you read, and I can't process it that quickly.
I'm sorry. I will. I'll try to slow down, and if I don't, out of conditioned thinking, just remind me, or throw something at me. Yeah, throw a shoe at me next time, and I'll slow down a little bit. I'm sorry. So let's meditate. Most of us meditated this morning too. So we'll just do a 10 minute, just to kind of 15. Does anybody want longer?
20.
Okay, 20 it is. I like meditating, but I don't want it to feel like that. Even that's too much. But I don't think 20 minutes will be too much, will it? Maura, what are you saying?
No, I'm just looking at everybody. Are you okay?
What?
With everything? Yeah.
20 minutes is perfect timing too. It brings us right to 11. For some reason in the schedule, and I shouldn't shake my head about why it's there because I wrote the schedule out, but it says from 11 to 11:30 we're going to have Q&A. If you want it, we can, but I wasn't planning on it. I tell you what, we'll meditate, and if there are any questions, we'll take it right after we're done with meditation, and then we have a little break before lunch too. So, what? And we don't have to either. And so now I'll qualify that. If we have a Q&A after our meditation, and you feel like you just want to go take a walk around these beautiful grounds, go ahead. So,
I'm just
going to
say exhale.
And exhale. Whoa. Yes. So maybe I was a little bit excited about this talk, but this talk this morning is what I've been looking forward to for 6 months, to present it this way. So, thank you. So find your relaxed meditative posture. And holding your back straight, but not stiff. Your ears aligned with your shoulders. Nose aligned with your navel. And holding yourself very loosely, very gently, very lovingly. Allow yourselves to settle into this room. Settle onto your seats. Settle into your bodies. And settle into your minds. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just get a feel for what that's like. To be mindful of your breath in your body. And while remaining mindful of your breath in your body, notice that thoughts are flowing. We're conscious beings, thoughts should be flowing. The purpose of Shamatha Vipassana meditation is to not be distracted by our own thoughts. So when you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. I'll repeat that. When you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. And we'll meditate for 20 minutes. not following a thought with a thought, remaining mindful of our breathing. If a persistent thought or feeling arises, stay with it for a moment or two, recognize it as impermanent, and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. And we'll meditate for 10 more minutes. Take a moment to notice the quality of your mind. Be at peace with your mind. So I was speaking with someone after breakfast, and we're just talking about how fortunate we are just to be here and have these teachings available and accessible to us. And to me, that's the most remarkable thing when I finally got a handle on what the Buddha was trying to teach, that these incredible teachings are still here 2,600 years later, and that I have a mind, and not that it needs to be any kind of special mind, but I have a mind that can understand these teachings and put them into good use. I mean, we're so fortunate to have that in each other. One thing I wanted to point out, and I don't think I did, that selfing or not self, impermanence and dukkha are the three marks of existence. And so everything the Buddha taught was in the context of the Four Noble Truths, but in relation to these three marks of existence too. The three marks of existence mean that they're common to all humanity. It's part of being in the phenomenal world. And it's not included in the schedule or the talks that you have, but I think I might close Sunday with a little bit more on the three marks of existence. I think it might put things into a little bit better perspective than talking about the hindrances, which I can mention in just a couple of minutes. So, and what I'm reading on the Kindle is the same thing that's in the booklets that you have too, if you didn't realize that. So you can reread it or something if you need to. Are there any questions? And what I was going to say is, if you have any questions right now, please bring them up. But also, we went through a lot. We covered a lot, and I went through a lot, like we're landing on Normandy. We've covered a lot, and it's best to just let it go for a while. You don't need to develop complete understanding before lunch. let your mind stay relaxed and stay calm. That's really what the retreat is about. It's also a retreat about taking... This is the most important teachings, I think, that mankind has ever been given, and we shouldn't take it too damn seriously. You know, we shouldn't take it too personally. We should, meaning develop it in our own time. Be gentle with ourselves even about this. If there's any questions, maybe when we come back from Matt's Qigong this afternoon, we can talk about this a little bit more, and then I'm going to talk about it a little bit more. And then we'll be done for it. Tonight in the main hall, we're going to talk, will be the Buddha's first teaching after awakening to this. And so it's really nice in context, keeping it in context. The Buddha's first teaching on establishing the Four Noble Truths, where Kundana awakened. It's going to be whether the talk is great, I don't know, but it's going to be a wonderful experience being in that hall and watching the sunset over the Catskill Mountains. So, if there are any one or two volunteers that would clean up after lunch, the facility would appreciate it. I think Maura said that she's organizing that.
Well, it kind of happened organically. Oh. Who would like to do lunch?
And again, nobody has to. Don't feel you're obligated.
Oh, you got 2 minutes?
You did this morning, didn't you? Or you ended up getting kicked out. So Jen, let's do Jen and Judy.
Okay.
All right. And Matt and Casey, like, you can always slip in there and like, we just did a lot of drying and stuff to make it slip out.
Or you could do it tonight. You could take the evening.
Okay,
the evening
tonight. Okay, these guys are on tonight. You're there for. We got a cover for today.
And it doesn't have to be two, though. If all of you want to go in the kitchen tonight, you could too. So nobody's going to say no. But they would appreciate one or two. And it's really nice. they really do bend over backwards in some ways to accommodate our group. They like having us here, but they also make accommodations for us too that they don't make for everybody. So, Kevin.
Can I just say one thing?
Please.
To you. You said you've been thinking about this talk for 6 months, so I want to say thank you. because I'm very grateful for it. It is a lot of information, but I feel the way you presented it is very thorough. You know, we did get a lot of engagement going on, but I think it's very clear. I think it will set in. I think it's a very great approach. I don't know about that talk yesterday, but this is...
Thank you for both comments.
We're very grateful for you as our teacher and this wonderful setting, and I needed to add that.
Thank you. A teacher needs good students. I'd be a real fool to sit up here talking about this in an empty room, wouldn't I? Thank you all. Let's enjoy the next hour and have a nice lunch. What a beautiful day. Maybe we'll have our class outside if it's still nice.
It's supposed to be in the 70s.
Yeah, maybe we will. Thank you all.